turn this on.
That's because you were looking at me. I was going to say it.
Okay.
We're talking about all that food. It seems like we should have said.
Yeah. Okay, we are beginning chapter 25 today. And this is the title of this is Practical Teachings. So it's full of the little, you know, wisdoms of life kind of thing.
Benjamin Franklin.
Yep. And there's a note here that's kind of interesting. It says, from chapter 25, verse 1, through 32, verse 15, it's a long section like similar ones in other parts of Sirach. It's a motley collection. It's interesting they use the word motley, you know. It's a motley collection of proverbs and sayings, this time to do with family and social life. To begin with, there's a series of proverbs about harmony between brothers, friendship among neighbors, concord between husband and wife. It stops to consider the misfortune of someone with a malicious wife. He's got to think about being women, you know.
Yes, he does.
And the good fortune of someone with a virtuous wife. But then new themes come in, the danger of being greedy for gain, control of the tongue. He talks a lot about that, about the dangers of, you know,
this problem.
Yeah, they've been around forever, right? Hypocrisy, the evil effects of desires for revenge, and the good effects of forgiveness. More on the subject of slander. He's talked about that a couple of times before. He brings it up again. Precautions to do with loans, like lending people money.
That always bothers me in the, like it was in the reading last week again, that, what do they call it? Not usury, but something else.
Simony or something.
That you shouldn't charge interest. You should give without.
Yeah, well, that was
interest. That was the culture.
The culture, yeah.
Okay. So we don't have to quit our banks.
Right. So more on the subject of slander, precautions to do with loans, praise for almsgiving, warning about giving surety. Like if you're going to give surety to someone on a loan, be careful who you're giving the surety to, because you will end up with the debt. Duties of hosts and guests, upbringing of children, health, wealth, and happiness, the allurement of wealth, good table manners, moderate drinking, and further maxims about dining. So he's covering like the whole social scheme, you know, here. He's got everything covered. Yeah, the only thing he didn't cover was murder. And so for the first 11 verses, from 25:1 through 25:11, he says, the wise men of the Middle East sought wisdom in order to find happiness. Every human being wants to be happy, but it is not easy to work out how to attain complete happiness. Ben Sirach sets out the subject in some numerical proverbs and draws the conclusion that there is no one superior in happiness than him who fears the Lord. This fear of the Lord has already been pointed out, as has already been pointed out, does not mean an attitude of fear. It means the respect that is due to the Creator and the author of the law. This respect is shown by attachment to his commandments, which spell out the right moral order. Then he's got a quote here from John Paul II. It says, since the moral order reveals and sets forth the plan of God the Creator, for this very reason, it cannot be something that harms man, something impersonal. On the contrary, by responding to the deepest demands of the human being created by God, it places itself at the service of the person's full humanity with delicate and blinding love, whereby God himself inspires, sustains, and guides every creature toward its happiness. That's from John Paul II.
We should copy that and take it around, because people always question what fear of the Lord is.
Yeah.
And that's such an excellent answer. Just respect.
Yeah. Well, that was a problem Mary Beth had when she was going through her conversion process to come into the church. This fear of the Lord, she'd be scared, you know. Mm-hmm. And it took, and once she understood what fear of the Lord really was.
Because we have a different understanding.
That's right. It made all the difference to her. Mm-hmm. You know, it really did. And so she mentions that several times to different people that she meets, that it was such a striking thing for her to finally figure out what fear of the Lord meant.
And a lot of Catholics say the same thing, because they've never had it explained.
That's right. That's true.
Yeah, they feel like approach you with trembling. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's prayer, yeah.
I think the nuns missed that.
Well, you know, it even when you go to confession, when you say the act of contrition, you know, blessing for you know, forgive me, you know, for what do you say? How does it go?
Fear of punishment.
But fear of punishment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For fear of punishment, yeah. But most of all because of the
offending.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So that almost forgot the
after
contrition. I haven't seen it in my whole life and almost forgot it. Oh my gosh. Anyway, let's go to Ben Sarak. He's smarter than I am. My soul takes pleasure in three things, and they are beautiful in the sight of the Lord and of men. And then there's an alternative translation they give here. It says, in three things I was beautiful, and I stood in beauty before the Lord and men. So he's talking about doing the right things actually makes you beautiful interiorly. And when I read that, it brought up to mind something the Blessed Mother said at Medjugorje when she appeared to the children one day during one of the apparitions. They said, why are you so beautiful? How are you so beautiful? And she said, I'm beautiful because I love much. Mm-hmm. He said, that's the source of my beauty. Mm-hmm. I thought that was an interesting thing to say, you know? Because
yeah.
You meet people that are very, very kind. They kind of look beautiful in many places, you know? They really do. They have this kind of aura about them that's very attractive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Agreement between brothers, friendship between neighbors, and a wife and a husband who live in harmony. Those are the three things that the soul takes great pleasure in.
Say them again.
He says, these three things are beautiful in the sight of the Lord and of men. Agreement between brothers, friendship between neighbors, and a wife and a husband who live in harmony. Three things. See, my soul hates three kinds of men.
They're all Republicans.
Yeah, they're all Republicans.
I think I need to put that.
See, my soul hates three kinds of men, and I am greatly offended at their life. So he's three things to get pleasure in, and then he hates three things: a beggar who is proud, a rich man who is a liar, and an adulterous old man who lacks good sense.
Put so politely.
I wonder if he had good sense, would he still feel the same way? Well, if he's adulterous, he doesn't have good sense, right? So, there you go. Okay, so you have gathered nothing in your youth. How then can you find anything in your old age? What an attractive thing is judgment in gray-haired men, and for the aged to possess good counsel. How attractive is wisdom in the aged, and understanding and counsel in honorable men. Rich experience is the crown of the aged, and their boast is the fear of the Lord. With nine thoughts I have gladdened my heart, and a tenth I shall tell with my tongue. So he's got a numbers thing going here, three and three and now nine. A man rejoicing in his children, a man who lives to see the downfall of his foes. Happy is he who lives with an intelligent wife, and he who has not made a slip with his tongue, and he who has not served a man inferior to himself. I wonder how you would decide who is inferior to you or not.
That's very difficult. That'd
be a tricky thing to prove to yourself, because you might think somebody's inferior, and they really aren't, you know. Happy is he who has gained good sense, and he who speaks to attentive listeners. How great is he who has gained wisdom, but there is no one superior to him who fears the Lord. The fear of the Lord surpasses everything. To whom shall be likened the one who holds it fast? And then there's an alternative here. Well, an addition, actually, because if you notice, it goes from verse 11 to 13. They add a verse 12. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of love for Him, and faith is the beginning of clinging to Him.
Why do they pull that out? Why do they skip these numbers?
I don't know. I didn't do the translation. I'm not the biblical scholar that they are.
I thought that he was.
It has a lot to do with the translation, and when they have disputes over something that they're translating, they just kind of toss it.
Relegate it to the notes.
But these guys at least tell you what other people say,
Yeah.
And there's another, a little later on here, there's a string of like 10 of them in a row with a skip like 10 verses. And so they've inserted those. So we'll go through those when we get to them.
So if we went back to the Douay Rheims or even earlier, would they be included, do you think?
I don't know.
Is it that recent or no? Maybe?
I don't know.
Okay.
We could look.
I have to do my homework.
Yeah. Yes. If you got to do a Reeves at home, you can check it out. I've got one, too.
I can write a report.
Yeah. Yeah. You can check that. And I've got a Jerusalem Bible, too. Maybe I'll check that, too. See if they're there. Okay. So then he gets to the next section, beginning on verse 13. And the title of that is The Evil Woman.
Oh, dear. We're good
okay.
now.
So you got to watch these evil women, you know. And he's got a note here. That covers the space from 25:13 through 26:18. He says, here we get a number of maxims and thoughts to do mostly with women. In the Old Testament as a whole, and particularly in some passages, one needs to remember that there is a progression, a gradual line of development in Revelation. Some ancient texts, including some of the ideas contained in this passage, reflect an outlook that was superseded in later stages of divine revelation. In other words, you know, women were inferior, they were property, and they couldn't hold property, all those crazy things that they used to do. So some of that's found in here. But as revelation progressed, God told us to start respecting women as equals, and they set the Blessed Mother up as the greatest woman ever, so. It says, from the very beginning, God created man and woman equal. In many cultures, including that of Israel, menfolk treated women unjustly and as lesser beings. By his example and teaching, Jesus opposed that tradition which discriminated against women. In this tradition, the male dominated without having proper regard for woman and for her dignity, which the ethos of creation made the basis of the mutual relationships of two people united in marriage. And they said that's mostly also comes from John Paul II and his Mulieris Dignitatum, the dignity of women. Okay, so we will begin talking about the evil woman. But take heart. That's followed right after in verse 26 with the virtuous wife. Yeah. At the end of this, we get into 26. We get to 26, which is the virtuous wife. So he kind of redeems himself.
Okay.
So the evil woman, any wound, but not a wound of the heart. Any wickedness, but not the wickedness of a wife. Any attack, but not an attack from those who hate. And any vengeance, but not the vengeance of enemies. There is no venom worse than a snake's venom, and no wrath worse than an enemy's wrath. So I guess he's talking about women here, because it's about the evil women,
He's talking about snakes.
Yeah, I mean, he's using a lot of similes for evil women here that are very nice. And then he goes on, he says, I would rather dwell with a lion and a dragon than dwell with an evil wife. Wow. That's a little bit of an exaggeration there. I don't know, maybe not for him.
Where's he been hanging out?
Yeah. The wickedness of a wife changes her appearance and darkens her face like that of a bear. Her husband takes his meals among his neighbors, and he cannot help sighing bitterly. He won't even eat. He's afraid to eat her food. She's afraid to be poisoned or something.
But didn't they have lots of wives at that time?
Do I?
At this time, didn't they have lots of wives?
In some cultures, yeah. I don't know. I guess in Israel, they could for a while because Solomon had 800 wives or something,
right. So he must have had uncommon bad luck.
Yeah. Yeah.
Poor taste.
But it sounds like he's talking about one.
Yeah, that's why I'm questioning.
Yeah. So anyway. So her husband takes his meals among the neighbors, and he cannot help sighing bitterly. He's not happy. Any iniquity is insignificant compared to a wife's iniquity. May a sinner's lot befall her. A sandy ascent for the feet of the aged. Such is a garrulous wife for a quiet husband. That's an interesting way to...
It is.
Does that mean snarky?
A sandy ascent for the... It's like trying to climb up a sand hill, you know? Because you keep falling back and you never make any progress. Yeah. You never get ahead. Such is a garrulous wife for a quiet husband. Do not be ensnared by a woman's beauty, and do not desire a woman for her possessions. There is wrath and impudence and great disgrace when a wife supports her husband. What? There is wrath and impudence and great disgrace when a wife supports her husband.
Maybe they missed a word. Doesn't support her.
I don't know. A dejected mind, a gloomy face, and a wounded heart are caused by an evil wife. Drooping hands and weak knees are caused by the wife who does not make her husband happy. From a woman's sin had its beginning. Because of her, we all die. Allow no outlet to water and no boldness of speech in an evil wife. If she does not go as you direct, separate her from yourself.
Divorce.
It's an interesting thing here. From a woman's sin had its beginning. Because of her, we all die. They're blaming the whole fall of man on Eve.
Yep.
Here, mm-hmm. Which is very common.
Yeah, okay? That's the way we learn.
Oh, yeah.
If she hadn't done it, it would have been all right.
But when you go back and read it, mm-hmm. And you read it, you know, very slowly, it says Eve ate the fruit of the tree. Mm-hmm. Did anything happen to Eve? No.
It doesn't say that.
No. She just said, husband walks up, you know, Adam walks up, and she said, here, take some.
Because he...
It's only because he ate it mm-hmm. that everything happened. Mm-hmm. They had to both eat it. Mm-hmm. Why? Mm-hmm. Why couldn't it happen just when she ate it?
Because the two are one, they're married.
They're married.
He's the head of the house.
I was going to say because they have to be married, yeah.
Yeah, they're married. When they got married, they formed a new spiritual unit. Right. They were together, joined by God. Okay. And if they had children, if only she disobeyed, but he did not, and then they had children, there's a question of what would the children? Would the children be like Adam or be like Eve?
Like Adam.
Yeah,
because it didn't matter that she ate it. It only mattered that nothing would have happened.
If they both did. Yeah. So it's an interesting thing. And so Satan had to attack them before they had children. Because God said, go forth and multiply the earth. And Satan did not want them multiplying the earth with people that were in that kind of union with God. Because he hated God that much. So he had to get to Eve and get her to fall and get Adam to fall before they had children. Because after the fall, their very nature changed. They were immortal and they became subject to death and all the other, you know, results of that fall. You know, ill-tempered, the lack of control over your concupiscence and everything else.
Work.
You know? Yeah, they had to work for a living now and fight brambles and bushes and, you know, all the difficulties because of the fall. And so their children would then inherit their fallen nature, mm-hmm. not the nature they had
right.
before the fall. Because that fall changed their very essence, changed their very being, and so it changed their DNA, which they then passed on to their children.
Which is hard for people to understand.
Yeah.
Even today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think especially.
Especially today.
So now we get into the the virtuous wife. So you guys can start smiling now.
Way too long.
You can be, if you're a lady, you can be happy now because you can be virtuous. It says, the virtuous wife. Happy is the husband of a good wife. The number of his days will be doubled. So if you're a good wife, but you don't like your husband, you don't want him to live a long time, you got to do something different. You can't be a good wife anymore because his days are going to be doubled. So a loyal wife rejoices her husband, and he will complete his years in peace. A good wife is a great blessing. She will be granted among the blessings of the man who fears the Lord. Whether rich or poor, his heart is glad, and at all times his face is cheerful. So that's what happens if you have a good wife. So a virtuous wife, that's a good thing.
So it's all our fault.
Yeah.
Whatever happens, yeah.
Yep. So now he gets into another section that gets kind of interesting. It's called Types of Women. So he's going to go through a bunch of different types of women. So he's got this thing about women. You know, we've seen that before.
Yeah, he sure does.
We've seen that before. And I, maybe he had a bad experience with a girlfriend in high school or something, you know. So I don't know. But maybe he had some bad experiences. Anyway, he thinks he's learned about women from this. So types of women.
This is an
inspired. So he's back with the numbers thing again. He says, of three things my heart is afraid, and of a fourth I am frightened. The slander of a city, the gathering of a mob, and false accusation. All these are worse than death. So those are the three things that his heart is afraid of. There is a grief of heart and sorrow when a wife is envious of a rival, and a tongue lashing makes it known to all. An evil wife is an ox yoke which chafes. Now, why would he make that statement? When you make a yoke for a pair of oxen, you don't just grab one off the shelf and say, put these two oxen into it. They're actually shaped for the particular animals.
Well, that makes sense.
So it's comfortable for them when they're pulled. It's not chafy against their skin and stuff like that. It says, an evil wife is an ox yoke which chafes. So it's always irritating. It's always cutting, annoying, and everything. Taking hold of her is like grasping a scorpion. There is great anger when a wife is drunken. She will not hide her shame. A wife's harlotry shows in her lustful eyes, and she is known by her eyelids. I thought that was interesting, statement.
Eyelids.
They either
those eyelashes. Eyelashes,
yeah. Maybe she's either got droopy eyes, or she maybe paints her eyes or something.
Who knows?
You know, whatever. But it shows in her lustful eyes, and she is known by her eyelids. Keep strict watch over a headstrong daughter, lest when she finds liberty, she use it to her hurt. So watch out for your daughters, too. Raise them right. Be on guard against her impudent eye, and do not wonder if she sins against you. As a thirsty wayfarer opens his mouth and drinks from any water near him, so will she sit in front of every post and open her quiver to the arrow. That's an interesting way to put it.
I think you should just pass it.
Maybe we'll skip that last part. But that's the most colorful way I've ever seen it put. A wife's charm delights her husband. And her skill puts fat on his bones. A silent wife is a gift of the Lord.
Oh, dear.
And there is nothing so precious as a disciplined soul. A modest wife adds charm to charm. And no balance can weigh the value of a chaste soul. Like the sun rising in the heights of the Lord, so is the beauty of a good wife in her well-ordered home. Like the shining lamp on the holy lampstand, so is a beautiful face on a stately figure. Like pillars of gold on a base of silver, so are beautiful feet with a steadfast heart.
I guess he likes tall women.
Yeah, that's verse 18. And now we have verses 19 through 27 that are missing and are added here.
It got rated X.
Good, I'm glad they skipped it.
So we'll start with 19 here. It says, "My son, keep sound the bloom of your youth, and do not give your strength to strangers. Seek a fertile field within the whole plain, and sow it with your own seed, trusting in your fine stock. So your offspring will survive, and having confidence in their good descent, will grow great. A harlot is regarded as spittle, and a married woman as a tower of death to her lovers. A godless wife is given as a portion to a lawless man, but a pious wife is given to the man who fears the Lord. A shameless woman constantly acts disgracefully, but a modest daughter will even be embarrassed before her husband. A headstrong wife is regarded as a dog, but one who has a sense of shame will fear the Lord. A wife honoring her husband will seem wise to all, but if she dishonors him in her pride, she will be known to all as ungodly. Happy is the husband of a good wife, for the number of his years will be doubled." They've already said that once. "A loud-voiced and garrulous wife is regarded as a war trumpet for putting the enemy to flight. And every person like this lives in the anarchy of war." So that's his take on types of women. So the next session begins with verse 28, and it's titled Uprightness. At two things, he's got into this rut now where he's numbering things he likes and doesn't like. So he said, "At two things my heart is grieved. Because of a third, anger comes over me." What are those two things? A warrior in want through poverty, and intelligent men who are treated contemptuously. So those two things grieve his heart. A man who turns back from righteousness to sin, the Lord will prepare him for the sword. So that's the one he's angry about. A merchant can hardly keep from wrongdoing, and a tradesman will not be declared innocent of sin. So he's thinking that they try to cheat a lot to make more money.
Sounds like always.
Yeah. But he's kind of putting a broad brush on all of them, you know.
Really?
There probably were some honest people back then. You would hope so. You know. So then we get to chapter 27. 27. It says, "Many have committed sin for a trifle, and whoever seeks to get rich will avert his eyes. As a stake is driven firmly into a fissure between stones, so sin is wedged in between selling and buying. If a man is not steadfast and zealous in the fear of the Lord, his house will be quickly overthrown." So the first one is kind of interesting because it says, many have committed sin for a trifle. Over something that's really insignificant. Just a very small front. Maybe somebody overcharges you 2 cents for something. You know, so they get all angry and then fall into sin because of that instead of just blowing it off and forgetting it.
Like who sold his birthright for soup?
Yeah, like Esau and Jacob, yeah. You know, be a Jacob, not an Esau.
Okay. I wonder if this is like an anti-agrarian viewpoint. Like he's seeing more and more people go into commercial attempts and leaving the agrarian.
That could have been a lot of his own personal experience,
yeah,
too. Maybe he was a merchant.
Yeah.
or had to go to them a lot to get supplies and stuff, you know. It says, when a sieve is shaken, the refuse remains. You've all seen that, making cakes and stuff. You know, you get a little bit of stuff left over sometimes. So a man's filth remains in his thoughts. That's an important thing, too, that a man's filth remains. When you expose yourself to evil, it's hard to forget it. It stays with you. You know, you see something, and you years later, you can still remember what you saw.
Avoid if it was the occasions of sin.
Avoid the occasions of sin, right? Exactly. The kiln tests the potter's vessels. So the test of a man is in his reasoning. The fruit discloses the cultivation of a tree, so the expression of a thought discloses the cultivation of a man's mind. So you know how his mind is formed and how it thinks when you listen to what he says. Do not praise a man before you hear him reason, for this is the test of men. After I read this, I was watching America's Got Talent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like to watch that show. It's a lot of fun. But what amazes me is that people... Oh, Alan dropped off. He's coming back on. That a lot of times when somebody starts to sing or something, the crowd goes crazy when they've only heard two notes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you know the rest of it's really going to be any good? Wait till after and then applaud, you know? But they don't. They go crazy the minute they hear the person start. It's kind of crazy. If you pursue justice, you will attain it and wear it as a glorious robe. Seek and you will find. Right? When you're looking for justice, you're looking for God, because he's the ultimate in justice. Birds flock with their kind, so truth returns to those who practice it. So if you always adjust, you always tell the truth, you're an honorable person, you're going to attract other honorable people to be around you. And people who are not that way are going to avoid you, because you're a disturbance to them, for the most part. A lion lies in wait for prey, so does sin for the workers of iniquity. So the lion there, of course, is Satan. He's going to look for every opportunity to tempt you and pull you away from God. Every opportunity. And he never sleeps. He's going to... Anytime he can get somebody further away from God, he's going to take the opportunity. Then he talks about discretion in speech. The talk of the godly man is always wise, but the fool changes like the moon. Changing one. You see a lot of politicians like that.
Is this all politics?
They'll blow with the wind. Yeah. When Father Fisher, his first assignment was at St. William of York when I was still there. And he gave a talk one day that was kind of interesting. He said, why did God change Peter's name from Simon to Peter? He said, I often wondered about that. So I looked up the etymology of the names and said, Simon means reed.
Oh, and Peter means rock.
And Peter means rock, right? He said he didn't want somebody leading his church who was going to sway with the political winds back and forth like a weed does in the wind. He wanted somebody firm, establish his church, establish his beliefs, his doctrine, and then keep it there firm. Don't let it sway in the political winds. Which I thought was a very interesting thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Interesting.
Yeah. Because God, you know, God changed a few people's names, you know. But that one kind of was an interesting take on it. Among stupid people, watch for a chance to leave. No, you want to get away from them. But you don't want to insult them. So you just wait for it. We'll have to go to the bathroom, you know, something, you know, get away from there. But among thoughtful people, stay on. The talk of fools is offensive, and their laughter is wantonly sinful. The talk of men given to swearing makes one's hair stand on end, and their quarrels make a man stop his ears. The strife of the proud leads to bloodshed, and their abuse is grievous to hear. So he doesn't like being around people that are fighting all the time and arguing and having discord and everything. Doesn't like that. Whoever betrays secrets destroys confidence. He talked about that once before, too. When people tell you a secret, keep it, you know. Was that in Wisdom or was that in Sirach? I forget. Anyway, that topic has come up before. Whoever betrays secrets destroys confidence, and he will never find a congenial friend because nobody's going to talk to him anymore. Nobody's going to tell him any secrets. Love your friend and keep faith with him. But if you betray his secrets, do not run after him. For as a man destroys his enemy, so you have destroyed the friendship of your neighbor. And the commandment, thou shalt not kill, comes in here too. Because you can kill somebody by destroying their reputation.
Right.
Some people have been driven to suicide over that.
Right.
You know? So, and as you allow a bird to escape from your hand, so you have let your neighbor go and will not catch him again. So don't watch how you talk about your neighbors. Do not go after him, for he is too far off and has escaped like a gazelle from a snare. For a wound may be bandaged, and there is reconciliation after abuse, but whoever has betrayed secrets is without hope, because that person will never trust you again. And that's why adultery is so hard. You betray that trust, and it's possible to get over it, but it's not easy. It takes a great deal of effort for that. Whoever winks his eye plans evil deeds, and no one can keep him from them. So if you're planning evil deeds, that's where your heart is. That's where your treasure is. And so no one's going to stop you from doing that. You got to stop yourself. You got to turn to God to stop that from planning evil deeds. In your presence, his mouth is all sweetness, and he admires your words. But later he will twist his speech, and with your own words he will give offense. I have hated many things, but none to be compared to him. Even the Lord will hate him. Whoever throws a stone straight up throws it on his own head. And a treacherous blow opens up wounds. He who digs a pit will fall into it, and he who sets a snare will be caught in it. If a man does evil, it will roll back upon him, and he will not know where it came from. Mockery and abuse issue from the proud man, but vengeance lies in wait for him like a lion. Those who rejoice in the fall of the godly will be caught in a snare, and pain will consume them before their death. So they're not going to have an easy death there. If you rejoice in when godly people fall and have trouble, you're not going to have it easy, because God will take vengeance on you. Anger and wrath, these also are abominations, and the sinful man will possess them. So he seems to like peace a lot. Doesn't want any kind of discord. Doesn't want to have any people arguing and fighting and everything, either in his personal life or with his friends. So we get to 28, and this is kind of the opposite. The title there is Forgiving Others. And they got some notes on chapter 8 here that are kind of interesting. It says, this passage, 28, verse 1 through 11, this passage contains three groups of sayings on one theme: seek peace and reconciliation, not discord. The first group has to do with forgiveness. one needs to forgive others in order to be forgiven oneself. The second group gives the various reasons for not bearing grudges against one's neighbor. We should remember who we are and how good God has been to us. The third warns against getting into arguments because they only make matters worse. Our Lord may well have had these or similar sayings in mind when he taught in the Our Father, "Forgive us our debts as we also forgive our debtors." Christian prayer extends to the forgiveness of enemies. And if we find that in the Sermon on the Mount. Transfiguring the disciple by configuring him to the Master. Forgiveness is a high point of Christian prayer. And so when you act like Christ, you are transfiguring yourself to become more like him, to imitate him.
Is this only when they're asking for forgiveness? Because in the last chapter, we were supposed to avoid them.
Well, when they ask for forgiveness.
This is if they ask
for repent, yeah. Right.
But you can still forgive them without that.
Right. I mean, generally, we get this message, but in the last chapter, we're just supposed to get away.
Yeah.
Yeah. And don't forget, this is toward the end of the Old Testament period, getting into Christ. So some of this stuff kind of morphs into Christ's teaching.
Love.
Yeah. Because he said, you know, do good to those who are
right.
bad to you.
Right.
So this is kind of leading into that, but it's not quite there yet. So we see some kind of leading into what Christ talked about in the Sermon on the Mount. It's kind of close, but not quite all the way there. So it's kind of leading into that. So Jesus probably had some of this in mind when he was given the Sermon on the Mount. Because he would say, you know, you've been told, but I tell you. You've been told, I tell you. Moses told you, but I tell you.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Since Christian prayer extends to the forgiveness of enemies, transfiguring the disciple by configuring him to the Master. Forgiveness is a high point of Christian prayer. Only hearts attuned to God's compassion can receive the gift of prayer. I thought that was very interesting. That's in the notes here. So only hearts attuned to God's compassion can receive the gift of prayer. So if you're not compassionate toward others and willing to forgive, you're not going to be able to pray properly.
Right.
Goes back to the Our Father. You know, forgive us our debts as we forgive others. If you can't do that, you can't really pray properly. And that's interesting because early on in Medjugorje, the Blessed Mother gave a message to the villagers. And she said, "You guys don't know how to pray." So she said, "I'm going to teach you how to pray." And what she did was take them through learning how to pray using the Our Father. And so that Our Father, you know, give us our daily bread, forgive us our trespasses, all these kind of things are so pertinent to how we should all pray all the time. Those themes, those attitudes. Maybe you don't say the Our Father prayer itself, but the messages in that prayer permeate other things in your life and in your prayer.
There is an instruction I read yesterday that if you don't want narcissistic children to grow up that way, you have to teach them empathy right from the beginning.
Yeah.
To see others as Christ mm-hmm. sees them.
Yeah, exactly.
Or they will be narcissistic.
Yeah, empathy is taught, yeah. I think there's a certain amount of it that's sort of natural because people want to be treated well.
Mm-hmm.
You have a tendency to want to treat other people well. But some people are just downright selfish.
Right.
You know, so you got to teach them the right way.
You're too old.
Forgiveness also bears witness that in our world, love is stronger than sin. The martyrs of yesterday and today bear this witness to Jesus. It's like Maria Goretti. While he was stabbing her, she was saying, I forgive you. You know, that, can you imagine stabbing somebody and they're saying, I forgive you while you're doing it?
Right.
That has to get to you. That has to just get to you.
Yeah, how many people?
And apparently it did eventually because he converted and was after canonization, you know.
I heard a young Iraqi boy whose whose brother was killed, who eventually became Christian and is speaking. But he was saying he learned that the killer of his brother was not his enemy, that Satan was the enemy,
yeah,
who had duped that killer, who was controlling that,
yeah,
killer. And so he said, and so I can pray for that person, mm-hmm, because I know the enemy is really Satan.
Somebody, yeah, had to pray for him to get that to grace, because how many can think that way?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's true. So forgiveness is the fundamental condition of the reconciliation of the children of God with their Father and of men with one another. And St. John Chrysostom, quoting this passage, writes, "Although you may not deliberately do harm to your enemies, if you fail to show goodwill to them and leave the wound open on their souls, you are disobeying the commandment laid down by Christ. How can you ask God to treat you with good grace if you yourself do not show mercy to those who have sinned against you?" As St. John Chrysostom. So early on in Christianity, that idea was already there, to forgive your enemies and that sort of thing. So beginning chapter 28 here. "He that takes vengeance will suffer vengeance from the Lord. So forgive us our trespasses, otherwise God won't forgive us. And he will firmly establish his sins. Forgive your neighbor the wrong he has done, and then your sins will be pardoned when you pray. Does a man harbor anger against another and yet seek for healing from the Lord? Does he have no mercy toward a man like himself and yet pray for his own sins?" So we should always pray for the conversion of sinners. "If he himself, being flesh, maintains wrath, who will make expiation for his sins? Remember the end of your life and cease from enmity. Remember destruction and death. Be true to the commandments." You know, when you join the Knights of Columbus, in the opening talk they give you, they show you this chart that says, "Tempus fugit, memento moris." Time flies, remember death. Always remember that you're going to die, so always stay prepared for that, because time flies fast. You never know when your death is coming. Could be next week, could be in 2 hours, could be 20 years from now. Gee, that'd be almost, I'd be really old if that happened.
Could be.
Yeah, it could be. You never know. You know, some of these biblical guys lived 900 yeah. years. You know, I can't imagine living that long.
No. Was that a true accounting?
I don't know.
Years?
I don't know.
There's a guy on the Protestant station saying it was because of cannabis, yes, and so they're selling it.
Oh, my
and using
gosh.
That biblical
is that right?
Reference.
Oh, oh my gosh. Says remember the commandments and do not be angry with your neighbor. Remember the covenant of the Most High and overlook ignorance. Refrain from strife and you will lessen sins. For a man given to anger will kindle strife, and a sinful man will disturb friends and inject enmity among those who are at peace. In proportion to the fuel for the fire, so will be the burning. And in proportion to the obstinacy of strife will be the burning. In proportion to the strength of the man will be his anger, and in proportion to his wealth he will heighten his wrath. So a lot of times when people are very wealthy, they get very proud and they get very angry very easily if people don't do what they say. You know, get him away, you know. He didn't move fast enough. A hasty quarrel kindles fire, and urgent strife sheds blood. Then we get into the next section, beginning on verse 12. It says slander and lies. So he's getting, once again, getting back to that theme of slander. So that he must have had people slander him at one point.
Yes.
You know, because he talks about it an awful lot.
I think it's common.
Right.
It's common today.
Yeah, I mean, it's still common today, but as often as he mentions it, he must have had some experience with it, I think. I mean, he doesn't say he did, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case.
Yeah.
So it says slander and lies. If you blow on a spark, it will glow. If you spit on it, it will be put out. And both come out of your mouth. Interesting.
Yeah.
Curse the whisperer and deceiver, for he has destroyed many who were at peace. Slander has shaken many and scattered them from nation to nation and destroyed strong cities and overturned the houses of great men. When I read the destroyed strong cities, I couldn't help but think of the Trojan horse.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big lie, you know, giving you a gift and destroy your city from the interior.
Mm-hmm.
Slander has driven away slander has driven away courageous women and deprived them of the fruit of their toil. Whoever pays heed to slander will not find rest, nor will he settle down in peace. One of the biggest examples we had of slander affecting courageous and virtuous women was the account we had in Tobit. Remember Susanna?
Oh, yeah.
And the guys accused her of being sinful. And then David had, I mean, not David. Was it David?
In Tobit?
Yeah. Was it Tobit? The guy who had to come to her rescue?
I know the story, but I don't know the details. Yeah.
Wasn't it Solomon?
No.
No.
The girl was in the garden,
right,
bathing,
yeah,
and these guys accused her,
yeah,
and so she went on trial. They were going to stone her,
yeah,
and
that young guy, who was he?
And the guy, who was he? Was his name David? Daniel. It was Daniel.
Daniel.
Daniel. So Daniel came and rescued her and showed that these guys were just committing slander.
Yeah.
You know. Anyway, that's what came to mind when I read this passage about women. Many have fallen by the edge of the sword, but not so many as have fallen because of the tongue. Happy is the man who is protected from it, who has not been exposed to its anger, who has not borne its yoke, and has not been bound with its fetters. For its yoke is a yoke of iron, and its fetters are fetters of bronze. Its death is an evil death, and Hades is preferable to it. It will not be master over the godly, and they who will not be burned, and they will not be burned in its flame, because they're godly. Because if you're godly, you have nothing that gives rise to slander,
right.
So you're not going to be burned in the flame of slander. Those who forsake the Lord will fall into its power. It will burn among them and will not be put out. I was thinking about Herod and the Magi there. You know, he was so deceitful there. See, I want to come worship God too.
Right.
You know,
yeah, tell us.
But he wasn't at all interested in worshiping God. He just wanted to kill him. Okay. It will be sent out against them like a lion, like a leopard. It will mangle them. See that you fence in your property with thorns. Lock up your silver and gold. Make balances and scales for your words, and make a door and a bolt for your mouth. Beware lest you err with your tongue, lest you fall before him who lies in wait. So we're a couple of minutes over, so we're going to stop here. We're now getting into chapter 29. The title of that chapter is Loans. So now we're going to get into the lending.
Right.
You know, be careful about who you lend to, and but be generous, and all those, you know, things you got to balance, like everything else. Everything is a balance.
We have enough to think about for this week.
Okay. Any final thoughts before we quit for the day? Okay. Have a great week.
Thank you.
See you next time.
God bless. Thank you so much.
Thank
God
you.
Bless. God bless.
Have a great week, everybody.
5 and 7, 12.